Today's show is sponsored by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean offers the simplest, most developer-friendly cloud platform. It's optimized to make managing and scaling apps easy with an intuitive API, multiple storage options, integrated firewalls and load balancers, a new managed Kubernetes service, and much more. From predictable pricing to flexible configurations to world-class customer support, you'll get access to all the infrastructure services you need to grow your business. Plus, DigitalOcean's community provides over 2,000 tutorials to help you stay up to date on the latest open source software, languages, and frameworks. So to get started on DigitalOcean for free, with a free $50 credit, go to do.co/cloudcast. That's do.co/cloudcast.
Cloudcast Media presents from the massive studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. This is The Cloudcast with Aaron Delp and Brian Gracely, bringing you the best of cloud computing from around the world.
Good morning, good evening, wherever you are. Welcome back to The Cloudcast. We are coming to you live from the massive Cloudcast studios here in Raleigh, North Carolina. You know, kind of a slow week in terms of cloud news of the week. I suspect that is because we are in August. It is summer vacation for a lot of folks, and probably particularly the venture capitalist and the M&A folks that are, you know, probably summering in Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard or somewhere in the Caribbean or somewhere in the Mediterranean or something. But, you know, we'll give those folks a few weeks off, a little bit slow news week. There was one interesting story that I noticed this week. You know, not a lot of acquisitions, not a lot of big announcements, but kind of a smaller announcement that I think will probably end up becoming a little bit bigger over time. GitHub announced that they are now offering CI/CD as a capability or a feature for GitHub Actions. And this is sort of important because I think it's one of those things where GitHub is still trying to remain as neutral as possible. They are beginning to slowly do more integration with Azure. You know, and I think as we see people beginning to make some decisions about, you know, are things like serverless or functions or just, you know, kind of code-based, low-code, no-code types of things becoming bigger, you know, we are seeing, you know, slowly GitHub is becoming not only just a place to store code, but a place where actually actionable things happen around that code. Now, not just collaboration, but things like actions, which are sort of a serverless type of function. We're now seeing CI kind of slipping in there. And I think we'll begin to see over time that GitHub becomes a more important sort of cloud within a cloud, right? So we often think about Google Azure and AWS as the three major clouds. I think we're going to begin to see GitHub really begin to emerge as sort of more of a developer cloud. So that'll be an interesting thing to watch over time. You know, definitely they sort of, I don't want to say they slow rolled it. It wasn't a massive announcement, but for those kind of in the know, you know, it kind of went out there, and I think it's something for us to keep an eye on. Maybe it's something we'll dig into in a later show. One other thing I thought was interesting, and I'll put it in the show notes, Gartner released their low-code, no-code magic quadrant. And this is an area that's always been sort of interesting to me. I think, you know, as we talk about software eating the world, developers being kingmakers, you know, at some point, the world can't just operate on the developers, the highest end of developers, the ones that make, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars. It's got to be sort of democratized a little bit more. And I think, you know, some of the low code, no code platforms don't necessarily get as much hype. But I think it's an area that we will see over time become more and more popular as data becomes more readily available. Development skills are sort of taught in colleges and elementary schools and high schools and so forth. And some of these low code, no code tools become more prevalent. You know, we talked at one point about AWS planning to roll out a low-code, no-code option at some point. Maybe that'll come out at reInvent. But I'll put that in the show notes, link to the Gartner thing. I know folks have different opinions on Gartner, but it is always kind of interesting to kind of get some perspective on, you know, who are the companies that are in general leading and also some of the up-and-comers in that space. So that's it. Going to wrap it up for Cloud News of the Week. Again, kind of mentioned as a slow news week. We do have a very interesting show for you today. We're going to talk with the folks from Etsy about their cloud migration from a lot of their data science-centric services from being on-prem into the cloud and how they went about doing that with the Google Cloud. So look forward to that interview, and we will get to that next. Today's episode is sponsored by Datadog, the cloud-scale monitoring service that provides comprehensive visibility into public cloud, hybrid cloud, multi-cloud environments with over 250 integrations. Datadog unifies your metrics, logs, and distributed request traces into one platform, so you can investigate and troubleshoot issues across every layer of your stack. Use Datadog's rich, customizable dashboards and algorithmic alerts to monitor cloud migrations in real time. To start a free trial today, and Datadog sending you a free t-shirt, visit datadoghq.com/cloudcast to get started. That's datadoghq.com/cloudcast. And we're back. Aaron, it is good to have you back. How you been, man?
Been good. How about yourself?
Doing well. You know, just got back from some of the summer break stuff. So summer is in full effect, and the heat is overwhelming at this point.
Yeah, no kidding. Absolutely.
So, you know, we I think we're always very lucky to get a lot of the guests that we have on our show, and a lot of times we get, you know, technology vendors, and they're talking about new technology, and not enough time do we get with some folks that are not only kind of on the building side of things, they're living and breathing the technology, but you know, we get a chance to talk to some of the companies that just really shape the internet. We're incredibly lucky. So you know, today we get a chance to do one of those things. So very excited to have Kevin McHale, who is one of the senior staff engineers at Etsy, especially on the data team. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hi, yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. It's a pretty intimidating introduction. I hope I can live up to it.
Oh, it'll be great. We're looking forward to it. You know, so before we dive into some of the work that you're doing at Etsy, you know, we look at your background, you've done a lot of things that have kind of nothing to do with online retail, and you seem to be kind of incredibly good at math. So give folks a little bit of your background, just some of the things that you've worked on, kind of some of the scale of things that you worked on even before coming to Etsy.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I don't know if I'd say I'm good at math, but I certainly studied it long enough to know how much I don't know. You know, my undergrad training was basically in math. I did a PhD in experimental physics, all of which taught me, you know, a lot about things that might not necessarily seem relevant every day to e-commerce, but that I almost feel like I do look back on a lot every day. I mean, just a lot of basic ways of thinking about things and solving problems and project management and stuff like that have all been really important to me, but, you know, and obviously really useful and things that I picked up during that period of time. But since then, I've kind of moved into the tech industry kind of slowly, starting more as an applied mathematician working for the US government, and then kind of gradually getting drawn into data science. And while doing that, learning a lot more about software engineering, and ultimately kind of culminating in my current position, which was the first time I've actually been formally a software engineer and not a, you know, data scientist or whatever.
Yeah, so it makes sense because it's so fascinating to hear. We're hearing more and more about backgrounds like that, or backgrounds that maybe are less traditional making into these roles. And then you get to be involved in some really, really cool and interesting projects, right? So there's two very interesting projects at Etsy, both kind of building, evolving the data platform, if you will, and then helping to manage this migration to Google Cloud Platform that we're going to talk about a good bit probably. So let's start by talking about the data platform, though, first. Could tell everyone a little bit about the evolution behind it and then the process and what happened during all of that.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, our data platform, so Etsy, first of all, is a two-sided marketplace for vintage and handmade goods. We've got...
Yeah, we are kind of making an assumption there, aren't we? So
I suppose we are. Yeah. You know, it's good to just sort of set the tone a little bit. You know, so we have something like 50 or 60 million items on our site, all of which are, or most of which are unique. Like these aren't things out of a catalog, like an iPhone or something. These are all handmade items or vintage items. And we've got, you know, millions of sellers, millions of buyers who are shopping on the site and trying to sift through this giant mass of stuff to find what it is that they're looking for, you know, for whatever the special, you know, sort of gift or whatever it is that they're trying to find that they will enjoy themselves or give to people or whatever. So you can imagine like connecting people with these items, helping them find what they're looking for is a big source of machine learning problems for us. So we've basically over the past couple of years, Etsy has identified machine learning as one of the core kind of company-wide initiatives to help try to improve that search and discovery process. And so in order to do this, we need to collect a whole lot of data. So basically every action that a buyer takes on our site will generate information that we collect on the back end. So, you know, things like clicking things, viewing things, favoriting things, searching for things. All of that is collected, and we generate over a terabyte of data a day. And we need to process that in order to, you know, produce better machine learning models or better recommendations and ad placement. We have all sorts of in-house machine learning products now that are on the site and that are powered by this platform. And so now getting, you know, more specifically to the platform itself, we're pretty reliant on Hadoop right now. And specifically, we use Scalding, which is a Scala wrapper on top of Hadoop. And we have something like, you know, I don't know, hundreds of workflows, thousands of jobs that are running daily and processing through all of this stuff. And, you know, going back a few years, we were doing all of this on-prem in a data center that Etsy, you know, was paying for. And we had hardware that we were sort of internally managing. And as we identified this machine learning priority and, you know, the volumes of data that we were collecting started going up and up and up, and our in-house, you know, in-house resources and in-house people just were not enough to keep up with this growing demand. And so that kind of inspired us to start looking at the cloud as one, you know, well, you know, Etsy generally was looking at a cloud migration for other reasons too, but for the data processing side of things, you know, this was a big motivator that we basically were just kind of at capacity or even above capacity, and we didn't have enough people or resources to catch up with where we already were. So now, you know, we basically over the past, say, year and a half, have spent a lot of time migrating all of this stuff that we had, all of these Hadoop jobs and, you know, all sorts of other kind of scheduled operations and databases and stuff on the data platform into the cloud. And in order to do this effectively, we had to kind of rethink the way things were constructed, because if we had just kind of lifted and shifted a big Hadoop cluster and turned it into a bigger Hadoop cluster in the cloud, we really wouldn't be, you know, we really wouldn't be gaining a lot of the benefits that are available to us by being in the cloud, such as, you know, elastic clusters that spin up and spin down as needed. Things like, you know, basically unbounded storage available through, you know, these big object stores that are available in the cloud. And another thing that was also a big motivator was with our big sort of single in-house cluster, everybody who was doing data science, which at this point, I checked yesterday, over a quarter of our engineers have contributed something to our data platform in the past year. So basically everybody at the company, or, you know, every team at the company is affected by this platform. And having everybody on a single cluster with a single scheduler just created really tight coupling between teams. And, you know, consequently, there were lots of problems when, you know, failures cascaded all throughout the system, or you know, well, you can imagine how things can go wrong. And so by moving into the cloud, we've also kind of focused on decoupling a lot of our systems so that, you know, individual teams like the data science teams and the, you know, recommendation teams can all have their own resources that operate independently of each other, and, you know, and give them the flexibility to do what they need to do while not imposing constraints on anybody else.
We've had a number of people on the show, you know, guests in the past who've talked about like application migration. So it was, hey, you know, we had front end or back end, and we migrated that into the cloud. We haven't necessarily had anybody with really deep expertise in sort of moving the data side of that into the cloud. Can you give some insight? I mean, you're still probably in the process of doing that, but when you're talking about that much information, moving it is not a trivial task. Can you talk about how you get it there, how you sort of do it in stages so you can keep using it in day-to-day operations? Kind of what goes on behind the scenes there?
Sure, yeah. That was an interesting balancing act that took about a year and a half. Like basically we knew for a long time that we were going to have to develop this new platform in the cloud, and that it was going to have to coexist with stuff that was on-premise for however long it took to move everything. And with a lot of these data processing things, you know, there's, you know, especially us as a platform team, we don't necessarily know what's going on inside of all of these jobs. We don't necessarily know, you know, we don't have assurances that we can run them, you know, in some new environment without clobbering data in some old environment, or making API calls to things that, you know, we shouldn't be making API calls to, et cetera. So we really spent a lot of time, and I think actually this goes back, you know, I mentioned earlier that my time as a scientist taught me a lot of things that are useful today. It certainly taught me like paranoia about data quality and data integrity and stuff. Paranoia is maybe a strong word, but I think that, you know, we treated this migration process as one in which basically none of these jobs could be trusted. And we need the ability to run any of them and to test any of them in the cloud, but none of them could be trusted to not break anything on-prem. So we basically created our cloud environment with really, really tight boundaries everywhere. And so, you know, we can run individual jobs in really tightly sandboxed environments and gate whatever comes in and out of those environments strictly through things like network bounds or firewalls or whatever. And kind of gradually over time, we built up this system wherein, you know, we had processing happening on-premise, and generally the on-premise stuff was, you know, always the highest level pieces of the pipeline. So like big data ingest jobs and big common share jobs that are used by everybody all across the platform. Those things remained on-premise for a really long time. And we would copy data up from on-premise into, you know, we're using Google Cloud, so into their cloud storage platform, you know, bit by bit. And then these sort of these little sandboxes in the cloud would kind of run in isolation, process that data, write their output out. You know, we'd look for errors, see what they're trying to do, and figure out what sorts of patterns we need to sort of like re-enable in these cloud environments. And kind of gradually over time, by just taking this really, really strictly, you know, bounded approach, we kind of just chipped away at the stuff that was kind of at the lowest levels of our processing pipelines and kind of moved step upward. And, you know, as of, I think 2 or 3 months ago, our data platform team finally finished moving the last jobs over. We, you know, turned off our on-prem clusters and we're fully in the cloud right now.
Interesting. Very cool. Now, let me ask you this, kind of a follow-on to that, because there was certainly a an analysis, if you will, of, okay, like you mentioned, data integrity. I actually like that idea of paranoia. but the that is certainly a big lesson learned and something you kept in mind very thoughtfully throughout. What are some of the other kind of lesson learned that maybe you didn't anticipate or didn't expect that maybe, you know, because you always hit these bumps, right? And some, what are some of the advice of some things to look out for others that are considering migration such as this?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think probably the most obvious one that I think everyone in the company now is aware of is that everything costs more than we thought it would.
In the public cloud?
In the public cloud. Yeah. We, you know, obviously, you know, it's difficult to sort of anticipate or sort of translate what our jobs were doing on-prem with what that will mean for our cloud costs in the future. And so, you know, we performed all this migration primarily focused on just getting things into the cloud and, you know, sort of figuring that once the jobs themselves were running in the cloud, we can do whatever optimizations were necessary. But it definitely turned out to be true that you know, there was a little bit of sticker shock, just primarily stemming from the fact that I think, you know, when we were in an on-prem environment, there was never really a forcing function to encourage us to try to optimize these jobs and to make them more efficient. You know, it was just, you know, the forcing function would only be you get more failure emails or whatever if you're running out of resources. Whereas now the cloud will happily run whatever it is that we tell it to do. And you know, that's great in some ways, but then in other ways, you know, sometimes you tell it to do something that maybe is a little bit too pricey. So I think that that was probably the biggest maybe lesson learned that things are going to be expensive, but I also view it as an opportunity in that, you know, it now does give us a real business case for spending time to optimize these things and make them more efficient, because we can, you know, directly impact Etsy's overall financial numbers if we can, you know, take a big chunk out of our costs by building more efficiency.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. Now, kind of a follow-on to that with the, you know, you mentioned you didn't want to do kind of a lift and shift in all mm-hmm. of this. And so in going to Google Cloud, or just really honestly public cloud in general, right? What are some of the advantages? Like it is funny you mentioned that cost was a bit of a surprise, because in the early days of cloud, everyone was kind of like, oh, you know, move it there because it'll be cheaper. And then mm-hmm. kind of everyone kind of learned that lesson over time, right? So what is some of the advantages you've seen? It's, you know, there's obviously like kind of the obvious one is the acceleration of some of those work and greater velocity mm-hmm. and flexibility. But tell us a little bit about, you know, some of the big advantages that happened there from both like business and technical mm-hmm. As this, you know, the data platform has evolved.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that, you know, I would have to say that, I mean, you know, maybe this is obvious. You guys are the Cloudcast. You guys probably, this is obvious to everybody. But, you know, for us, moving to managed services has been a huge win. You know, I mentioned earlier, you know, we had these big Hadoop clusters on premise that mm-hmm. were, you know, we're reaching a scale that we just didn't have the expertise to handle, I think. We did have to hire contractors occasionally to help us out with things. And now, basically, by being in the cloud, you know, Google is our ops team. Like, Google are the experts on how to configure these things. And so we don't need to have, you know, as specialized as like, you know, single function specialized teams anymore. We can have teams that are, you know, sort of broader in scope and, you know, take on a bigger mandate in terms of what it is that they're doing for the product without having to like, you know, hyper specialize in, you know, Hadoop hardware configurations or whatever. So that, I think, I've given the Hadoop example, but that has been a sort of a broad win all across the entire Etsy platform migration. You know, our search teams are using Kubernetes in the cloud, and this gives them all sorts of advantages like self-healing and things like that, and auto-scaling that they, didn't really have access to on-prem. And it's also, also aside from broadening the mandate, by using these things, it lets us sort of like punch above our weight class or, whatever the analogy is. Like, I have a team that I'm working on right now. Like, so I'm working on the machine learning team specifically on a project that's building out a sort of streaming Lambda architecture. I was kind of going through while thinking about, things I would say today, going through all of the services that we're using in Google Cloud right now and thinking through what it would take for us to manage these things, or their open source counterparts ourselves. And it would just be impossible. So our team is four people and we're using, Bigtable at a massive scale, where, which is a giant NoSQL database. We're using all sorts of streaming processing engines, all sorts of other analytics databases. And these are all things that we just create by, writing a few lines of infrastructure code instead of, having to research it and figure out what it takes to configure it and make them all work together. So I think that, now that our migration is complete and we're really able to start focusing on building new applications and building new logic on top of this layer, I really feel like the dividends are finally starting to become just really, really evident in that we can use all of these great technologies without having to have all the specialization needed to run them.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. If I kind of, correlate a little bit of what you just said, you said at the beginning, somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 million items on there and then a staff of four. So
yeah, exactly.
Right. That's a hell of a summary, if you will. Mm-hmm. I'll ask you a quick follow-up on that. So it's not often I get to talk to somebody who's both familiar with Google Cloud and has a data science background. And, one of the big things we've talked about on the show a number of times over the years is Google Cloud and kind of, each cloud has their kind of specialty and their services. And so, can you give us some kind of thoughts on like the data science, AI, ML aspects of Google Cloud that tends to be one of the things they hang their hat on, at least, publicly at like the Google Next shows and some of these other things. Do you have any kind of opinion? We hadn't really covered up until now, so it's kind of off the cuff question, mm-hmm. but I was just wondering on that.
Sure. Yeah. I do have opinions. Actually, it's interesting. So I'm sort of familiar with some of the products that they offer. Like they have their Vision API, which is a really awesome idea. You just send it an image and it will send you back tags that it has applied to that image, and you don't have to train any models or anything. And it's a great way, like off the shelf, to just kind of try something out and see if it's going to work. And it's, that and other things like it are really, really cool. And, I don't know of any other company that makes quite as many things just so easily available like that. But what's funny is actually in Etsy's case, we've tried using some of these things already. And what ends up happening is that we're always sort of bitten by the uniqueness of our items, that, we're not sending in, simple photos and asking like, is there a car in this image or not, or whatever. We're looking for really like nuanced analyses of, what our images might contain or whatever. And so we haven't yet found ways to use those APIs effectively, I think in large part just because of the kind of specialization that's needed to sort of, to work with Etsy's data generally, but then also to, especially make improvements over what we're already doing. But so aside from the AI stuff that they offer though, they do have some really great products, like BigQuery and Google Cloud Dataflow and PubSub, which are all, in the big data realm, and they're all things that we're using pretty heavily now. And these things I think are really compelling, systems in that, they're both really technically powerful. Like they all are, I think, based on Google's in-house tools, which are really impressive and which work really well. And again, they get back to that sort of like punching above your weight class kind of analogy. Like I don't know if there are any open source or other cloud provider tools that can rival these things, and even if there were, certainly if there were an open source, we would have to figure out how to run them ourselves and we'd require more specialists to have access to them, where here we just kind of turn them on. It's great.
Give us a sense. So you've talked about your background. So lots of background in, big computational environments, lots of math. But you also mentioned, hey, hadn't necessarily worked for, big sort of software environment mm-hmm. before. You've got a smaller team. You now have access to these really powerful tools and services. Like what's your interaction with Google Cloud in terms of going like, hey, how can we best use your tools? Like, what's the thing that's going to make you the most successful? How do you communicate with them? How do they kind of give you guidance, or like, how does that relationship work?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, we have a pretty high level, high tier of support with them. So we actually have some Google, you know, I don't know what their titles are, but we have some Google people who are like, you know, some technical people, some not as technical, but who are kind of embedded in our company at this point. So I can send Slack messages to people and ask them for things. And so that's kind of like the steady state, that mode of operation right now. And there, I think there are fewer, you know, day-to-day interactions like the ones you described. But earlier on, when we were kind of planning out the migration and thinking through what we were doing, we had a lot of meetings with a lot of Google's, you know, applications engineers, or again, I don't know what their titles were, but, you know, people who were able to sort of look at our architecture designs, give us feedback on, you know, all sorts of aspects of them. I mean, personally, I've learned some, you know, just general architectural principles from some of these people, in addition to, you know, best practices on Google. And, you know, and we did take quite a number of their suggestions from, you know, in order to make sure that what we were doing would have the highest probability of success while we were doing it. And it's mostly worked out. So yeah, we now that things are pretty stable, we don't interact with them so much generally, but we can if we want to. They're right there on Slack.
Yeah. And you know, I don't know if this is necessarily something that your team does. Obviously, you know, you've been part of the kind of replatforming of the data platform. You've been part of the migration. You know, at some point, the folks, you know, sort of the executive staff, the business side of Etsy goes, you know, we're making a big investment in this. We're taking on the risk of going through these changes. How do you communicate back to them, you know, progress, success, that things are getting better? Like, what's the metrics you use? What's the language that you use to kind of communicate how this data platform is evolving?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, I think during the migration, I mean, maybe this is like a lesson learned for me. Like, so during the migration, I think that there was a lot of, there were always a lot of unknown unknowns, you know? I mean, despite the fact that, you know, the cloud was great, Google support was great, we met with their data proc people all the time, who are the people behind Managed Hadoop service, you know, still we would kind of continually run into, you know, use cases that weren't covered or whatever. And so we always found it kind of hard to project outward while working on the migration, very far. So, you know, we were able to give them, say, a roughly 6-month window during which we thought things would be able to be moved. And, you know, that roughly ended up working out, but it certainly wasn't the degree of precision that I think they were hoping for. But I think now that things are more stable, there are a lot fewer unknown unknowns. You know, I think the types of things we can start to really quantify are things like our experiment velocity. You know, with this big corporate focus on improving the marketplace and getting, you know, making it easier for people, for buyers to find what they're looking for, you know, the only way we can really do that is by running lots of experiments on the site, be those, you know, things as simple as UI changes and to things as complicated as, you know, fundamentally redesigning machine learning models. And I think, you know, it's a good question, how would we communicate the benefit that the cloud has given us in a way, because there are certain things that we just couldn't even do on-premise that we're now able to do really easily in the cloud, which contribute to an enhanced experiment velocity. And so, you know, I don't know whether the business side was tracking sort of like experiment release rates, or they were certainly tracking like GMS growth rates and things like that. And I imagine over time, you know, hopefully all of these rates, if tracked, will show an upward trend by running in the cloud. But yeah, that's a really good question. And it's not something that like I necessarily concretely interact with so much on a day-to-day basis.
Well, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. It's you know, migrations always, they're hard to scope. You know, mm-hmm. people always think they're going to be easier than they think they are. I think in general, people are still trying to figure out, you know, whether you call what you're doing a transformation, a digital transformation, a whatever it is, like trying to communicate to people, like, I need you to be somewhat patient because we're learning, we're making changes. You know, like there isn't sort of like one language yet. You know, a lot of that I think is kind of, it depends on the situation. So I was curious if you'd figured it out. And I think I think what you went through is exactly what we've seen from a lot of people, which is, you know, we did the best we could. We didn't necessarily always know what the right thing was, but, you know, we learned it as we went along.
Yeah, a part of the experience makes me wonder whether, you know, another lesson learned might be that, you know, like often it seems like people choose either lift and shift or they I mean, I don't know how often people choose to do what we did, which was basically remake a new platform that, you know, can support everything the old platform did and move things onto it. But in thinking it through, I wonder if we would have benefited a little bit more by looking at something sort of in the middle and asking, you know, what kinds of improvements can we make before this migration to sort of set us up for, you know, quicker success during it. But yeah, I don't know. It's not something that you do every day. So
yeah, hindsight's always 20/20.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah,
Aaron, before we wrap it up, Kevin, let me ask you one last thing before we go, and we'll kind of wrap it up. Do you have a favorite item or favorite seller on Etsy? I mean, it's, you know, obviously you can't be too biased, but do you have something that you're just like, man, we saw this thing pop up and it's just really cool?
So in terms of a single thing, I'm not sure, but I am kind of a sucker. I've become a sucker for mechanical watches. You know, I think the part of me that's like fully embedded in tech every day, like all this virtual stuff, kind of has a really, I'm drawn to these like super, super complicated things that were made, you know, 100 years ago that are still ticking accurately today. And then we have a ton of great sellers, you know, a number of whom, you know, I've got favorited and I see their updates and stuff, who are just always finding cool items that, you know, somebody thought was a funky idea in the 70s or whatever and turned into a really cool mechanical watch. So that's my personal Etsy go-to. But yeah, we have tons of cool stuff. I recommend everybody checking it out.
Very cool. That's awesome. Very cool. Yeah. So Kevin, where can everyone find out more about you? You know, of course, I think at this point, everyone's going to know the website and we're going to have links, but tell everyone a little bit in closing how they can find out more about you.
About me personally?
Yeah.
Sure. So, I mean, you know, I have my LinkedIn. I don't know how many Kevin McHales are on LinkedIn. It's a pretty popular name, but I've also got my GitHub, McHale K at GitHub, and got maybe a few somewhat interesting things on there. I don't know. We've got an open source project that we released as part of this whole effort, so people can maybe check that out.
And we'll have a link to the engineering blog as well. It is called Code as Craft, and you had mentioned it earlier, but it is actually the name of the blog as well. So fantastic. Well, Kevin, thank you very much for your time. It was great to get your insight this week. And on behalf of Brian and myself, thank you again. And thanks to everyone for listening, and we'll talk to everyone next week.
Thank you for listening to The Cloudcast. Please visit thecloudcast.net to find more shows, show notes, videos, and everything social media.